You're listening to Face Off, episode 88, recorded September 27th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com.
All right. So for our first news and follow-up, I got sick, I think on Friday.
News and follow-up, I just got sick today.
So
news flash,
and it's Monday right now, just this 27th, yeah. So you're gonna be listening to this podcast tomorrow, and we're kind of sick and just winging it.
Yeah,
well, we're so, not winging it. We're too pro for that. We got our show notes set up and everything. There is no way
that the first episode we are gonna miss is because of a cold. There's no way.
We're not missing. We haven't missed an episode yet, and it's not. It's going to be something more drastic than a cold.
Exactly. Like
coming at you live with a cold.
Yeah, I'll never let that happen. All right, let's get into our real news and follow up. So last week we were talking about what was that app?
Sorry, it was a flower. Something. Flower.
I know.
It started with a D.
I know that as well. Yes. It's a distributed social network.
Diaspora.
Whatever. And we're talking about how it's sort of this distributed Facebook type app. Well, Mark found another article about an app called Thimble, which is a decentralized microblogging tool, which sort of means like it's a decentralized Twitter.
Yeah. So it's thimble.net. You can go there and check out their little presentation they've got set up. The idea behind it is that it's going to be a decentralized micro blogging tool like Twitter. So this is kind of like the diaspora of Twitter. So I looked at the presentation and went through the slides, and it looks like it takes advantage of pre-existing technologies to do what it needs to do. It uses like SSH to do the communication, and it also uses Finger. So what I really like about it is it's using stuff that already exists. Real easy, simple stuff, extending it to make a decentralized Twitter, kind of like Diaspora.
Well, we talked about in the episode how I was looking at like Laconica back in the day, and I thought that was sort of the way microblogging was going to go. This is basically what I was talking about, only with only this doesn't aim to sort of push to Twitter to make Twitter the sort of like hub in the middle of the hub and spoke. It seems to just sort of make it just ignores Twitter.
Yeah, this is kind of replace Twitter. But when you follow people, you'd be following people's computers.
Right. Or
maybe like a central server that, I don't know. There's no code that I can see. There's really little on the page, but it looks promising. Their slideshow is pretty nice.
Well, it's cool that people are thinking about it. And again, like what sort of brought Diaspora into the forefront was that people are like, man, I don't own any of my information. It's, you know, it's in Zuck's hands, and I don't trust him one bit. I don't trust Zuckerberg one bit. So it, you know, this is sort of the same thing of like, I own the instance. I own the copyright to the content I'm putting on there. It is mine to do with. People can't just scrape it or do whatever they want with it.
They also say that it does not involve birds or whales. And what's funny about that is because it's decentralized, you're not going to have problems where the whole infrastructure just drops off.
Right.
You might not be able to get to, you know, like a certain person's profile, but you'll still be able to get to something.
Right. The whole system can't fail well. Not easily, anyways.
So that is Thimble.net. As far as it making it big time, I don't know.
Yeah, it was just something we saw that was interesting. All right, let's get into our geek tool of the week. So our geek tool of the week involves traveling and computers, which are always sort of an interesting thing. A lot of times you'll find yourself in a situation where, you know, you go to a hotel or something and you purchase internet and, you know, they give you like one Ethernet, you know, there's one Ethernet plug-in and it's like, hey, you bought internet for this room, but you got, you know, two computers. What do you do if you can't tether to your Droid? You get something like the D-Link DWL G730AP wireless pocket router. So it's actually a router that is a wireless router that fits in your pocket. It's really small. What's cool about this one, it can be powered via USB or plugged in. And if you have an Ethernet connection, you can share that with all the computers around you.
Great. The other thing, too, to note is like hotels and things, often you're on the same intranet as a lot of other people. And from a security standpoint, being on the same intranet as other computers, you can often have security risks. This kind of...
This gives you a firewall and NAT. So, yeah, totally, totally. That's a great point.
One of the things that they suggest when doing public stuff is maybe use like a pocket router like this.
Yeah. So, cool. So I didn't even know they made routers this small. I saw an article where this guy mentioned this thing, and I was blown away. I didn't know they even made travel routers, I guess. I didn't think of it as like a big concern, but...
Well, as you know, I listen to the Security Now podcast, and they have talked about travel routers quite a bit, but as like I don't really travel that much, and you know, I haven't had a chance to even look at it, so I haven't seen one myself, so this is the first time I'm seeing it. But
well, this one's cool because it's a 802.11g, so it's, you know, it's pretty fast. It does enhanced security with WPA PSK, so it's not just, you know, WEP, which can be easily cracked. The WPA is definitely the better security. And it's just, it's small and convenient, and it's only $43. Cool. I expected it to be like $100, I guess, when I first saw the article. I was like, oh my goodness, that is going to be expensive.
I like the USB. That's really nice.
Yeah, that's cute, huh?
It's have a power outlet.
Absolutely. So check cool. it out. It is the D-Link DWL G730AP wireless pocket router. All right, let's get into our web apps this week. This our poor listeners. It's like there's no flash, there's no awesome. It's just like, nah. Let's move on.
All right, sick. Give us.
I know. Yeah, give us a break. Right, come on, you're busting my chops here. All right, our first web app. So the one thing we've been playing around with our new web app and business is we're doing some contract stuff. And the thing is, contract and legalese is a category of speak, legalese, right? So that just tells you that there's something not normal about it anyways. It can be very yeah. confusing. Our first web app is called WEX, which actually is part of the Cornell Law website. But WEX is a community-built, freely available legal dictionary and legal encyclopedia.
So you can browse terms, search... you can add and edit it, so it's kind of wiki, like a wiki style, yeah. I assume. Yep.
So yeah. I mean, a lot of these terms, I guess, let's say, you know, a lot of these terms or whatever would be in a regular dictionary, a regular encyclopedia, but what's nice about this is, you know, specifically you can browse for only legal terms, and, it, you know, it's a pretty authoritative source. I mean, anyone can go and edit, but I'm assuming that being it's sort of attached to the Cornell University of Law or Cornell, you know, School of Law, that, you know, it's a little bit more authoritative. I'm sure hopefully they do some curation or watching of it, of experts and students inside the school to make sure it's correct.
Yeah. It'd be interesting just to look, you know, like if you ever want to know what attorney-client privilege was or attorney general or attorney fees.
I think you're clearly in the A's.
Is that what I did? I am clearly in the A's. There are 425 A words. That are legal A words.
So malfeasance, right? This is a term you've heard before on the TV shows and stuff like that. I don't really know what it means, but you know, malfeasance, intentionally doing something that is illegal. This term is often used when a professional or public official commits an illegal act that interferes with the performance of his or her duties. For example, an elected official who accepts a bribe in exchange for political favors has committed malfeasance. There you go.
Yeah, that is clearly a word that is not in my vocabulary.
Right. Now it is, though. Yeah, exactly. You're going to be using it all, though. You'd be like, did you take my spoon? Yes, that is malfeasance. You knew you were committing a crime. And you're gonna be like, Mark, you need to settle down. So check it out. It's Wex. You can get the link in the show notes. It's just kind of a long one, so I'm not gonna do it. Our next web app comes to us from Philip Downer, who's been, you know, a huge help with the show. He's always sending us web apps and topics and stuff.
He's sending us a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So thank you. I love it. Thank you, Phil. Let's say it right now, because he's been giving us a lot of help lately. And you know what? If you have a community that helps you out, it's like, you know, when you're sick, like we are today, it makes it a lot easier to prep and record a show.
Yeah, we had another web app here, but we put it in the show notes. Like, we clicked on the link. It was like down for maintenance. We're like, oh, well, we can't talk about that.
Oh, man, this is bad.
So we had to swap one in, and I'm glad we picked this one, because once you told me what it was, I was like, well, that's actually pretty useful. So
right. One thing this web app doesn't do, so it's called Processor, which is processor.com, and it's sort of highlighted like it's processing CSS. It doesn't do a very good job of telling you what it does, but what it does is process your CSS. So what you do is you copy or paste your CSS, or upload a file, or give it a URL to a CSS file. And what you can do with that then is sort of process it to do different things. So like you can change like the styling of properties. You know, you can have properties on separate lines or same line. Indent, you could have, you know, one, two spaces, three spaces, four space indent. You can do sort of pretty things, like you can have the selectors on the same line or separate lines. And then the other one that really shows kind of how handy it can be is you can sort of columnize it, so you can get this really nice looking sort of one or two column layout and change the indent again. It's really cool because, like, a lot of times if you get like a compressed CSS file, or you get a CSS file with like five different people editing, and, you know, one of them has like two space indents, another one has like tabs, and, you know, it just gets ugly and mangled. You can put it in here and it'll process it, clean it up, and spit it out in a very useful way, the way you want it.
Yeah, nothing worse than getting a CSS file and it looks like they've been copying and pasting from all over the internet. You know, just one line CSS, you know, compressed.
Oh,
stuff
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm kind of OCD about having it nicely aligned. So you just take this big chunk of nasty CSS stuff, and you can actually pick the different styles. If you want your brackets to be on one line versus where your selector is, you can do that if you prefer one method over the other.
Absolutely.
He's got eight different methods on how to have the braces. So you can really take a big pile of junk CSS and turn it into something that looks pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Especially like you said, let's say you're looking at a site and they've got compressed CSS and you want to see how they're implementing a certain style or a button.
Right.
And,
oh man.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have Firefox or what is it? Firebug.
Well, still with Firebug, you can't easily copy and paste that into your app.
True.
Right.
You can just throw it in here, and at least you can kind of see their layout.
Yeah.
It's cool.
So check it out. Again, that comes from Philip Downer. You can get to him by going to twitter.com/manifestphil. That's CSS processor to help you process your CSS files. If you're listening to the show and want to be cool like Phil, because Phil is really cool, and have some news, a follow-up, a web app, or a geek tool or a topic you want us to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com. You can get to us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow or email us studio@faceoffshow.com. Either way, love to hear from you guys. We've gotten some great ideas, and we'd like to get more because they're always really helpful and cool. I mean, and sometimes it's hard. It's hard to find, you know, what's cool on the internet right now.
Yeah, you know, I browse Reddit and, you know, different things every day, but sometimes I miss some of the cool stuff. Like, I haven't seen the processor before.
Yeah. So go to the show and let us know what you guys want to talk about. So let's get into our topic this week, which it's a really interesting topic because it's something like, I would say that I know just enough about to get by and maybe to be dangerous. I know maybe about how the ecosystem works, but I don't really know how to do it or implement it myself. But as a web developer, we all have to deal with it at one point or another, and that is DNS.
So, DNS, when you suggested this topic, I was like, well, geez, I know DNS.
Doesn't everybody?
Translates a domain name into an IP address, right?
Right.
Well, I actually learned something within like the first three sentences of research.
Well, let's say typical use case, right? If you're a web designer, just kind of doing your basic, you know that when you switch hosts or if you, you know, do something, you have to change the DNS, whatever that means. Usually that means going into your registrar and putting in the new name servers or whatever they tell you to do when you buy the new one, right? And then all you know is it takes a while for everyone in the globe to see the same website. I mean, that's my typical use case before I really learned about DNS. It was like, I know it has to propagate, and so like that's why my client may not see the new website on the new host, for a while. But to the extent other than that, it's just, you know, you need to change DNS. There's just a lot more going on, and a lot more that makes the DNS system really cool.
Yeah. So, in other words, you know, DNS is kind of like the phone book. You've got a domain name like jaderobbins.com. And the DNS is like the protocol behind all the domain, you know, the GoDaddy, the, you know, your domains. Right. Jaderobbins.com actually needs to translate to an IP address because that's how computers communicate with each other.
This podcast is not affiliated with jaderobbins.com.
Instead of having to remember 204.14.62.18, you just need to remember jaderobbins.com and you can get to there.
Right.
Even if you change hosts or change computers.
It's purely a convenience thing for humans, right? Computers are good at remembering long strings of numbers. Humans are not. We like names and things that are familiar to us. So that's what the DNS system does.
So like a phone number, you can remember your name, Jade Robbins, but you may not remember your phone number.
Right.
Especially nowadays with Google phones.
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't. I barely know my wife's phone number. I have to think about it for like a good 30 seconds. So let's go through how your sort of typical DNS transaction works. I'm on my computer. And once again, I want to go to jaderobbins.com because I don't know if you know, it's a cool website. I type it in and my computer goes, oh man, I don't know what jaderobbins.com is. I don't know the IP address for that. So it asks the operating system has on record your DNS server. You know, usually it's given to you by your IP. It might be assigned to your computer automatically through DNS, but usually your ISP or someone has a DNS server that your computer can ask. So it goes to that DNS server and says, hey, do you know jaderobbins.com? And your DNS server may or may not know that. So, for example, where I work at Montana State University, all the DNS servers for Montana.edu stuff is local. So when I ask my local DNS server, it knows, you know, or it could be
cached.
So
if they make a change, it's propagated like immediately for
right
for at
exactly
least the university.
Yeah, because it's
because
you know
you're asking it's the authoritative.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I get to that level and it says, yeah, I know. But most of the time, you know, like I go, I go to jaderobbins.com, the DNS server doesn't know what it is. So what it does is it breaks it down. It says, all right, this is a .com, right? And I know the root level domain servers for .com. So it knows the list of all those. And so it asks one of them, it says, hey, you know jaderobbins.com? And the top level root one says, well, you know, I don't know jaderobbins.com, but I can tell you the DNS server that is the authoritative DNS server for jaderobbins.com. It's ns.dreamhost.com. Go talk to them. So then it goes and it talks to the authoritative one for jaderobbins.com, ns.dreamhost.com. It says, hey, do you know it's like after a while, it's like, God, do you know the address for jaderobbins.com? And it says, yeah, it's 69.164 dot, da, 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 da. And that propagates all the way back. And then your DNS server tells you that IP address and your web browser contacts that IP address and gets its information and it's all done.
Also, your OS may cache that IP address for later use in case you wanted to revisit jaderobbins.com.
Right.
I was going to say your local DNS server may also cache it as well.
Right, exactly, because it saves on requests. So, Bresnan, which is my internet service provider, right? After I go to jaderobbins.com, it has a DNS has like a built-in TTL, which I believe stands for time to live, and so basically it sort of like says like this is a fresh record for 9 days. So for 9 days it caches it. So anyone else on Bresnan that is pointing to that DNS server that goes to jaderobbins.com, it doesn't have to ask the root levels and sort of trickle down to Dreamhost because it has it cached. So it just says, do you know jaderobbins.com? Yep, here's the IP. I know this. I have this cached. And when that time to live is gone, it expires, then the cache is no longer valid and it will reverse up the tree and ask where it goes again.
So caching is great, but it can also be the bane of all these propagation problems where you know, you have to wait several days before, you know, maybe one computer can get to jaderobbins.com, but another one can't, you know, when you switch hosts.
Right. Because it's distributed, and its distributive nature can mean that it can be sort of not as performant as how you want it to be, because if my DNS server, you know, is really slow, that does take a long time. It takes longer for them to get to it. So, but because of its distributed nature, it's also very redundant. You know, there isn't sort of like one or two nodes that can go down and bring the whole internet toppling down to a crash.
Right, which is, I mean, that was the whole idea of the internet when they first started, was to make it very robust.
Right, exactly.
Fault tolerant. So the first thing that, you know, I mentioned, I opened up with talking about how I learned something right away. The first thing I learned about DNS was the top level domain is actually like the .com, the .net, .org portion of the full URL. So like .com, so domains are situated kind of like an organizational chart. If you were to think of .com as like the CEO, and then Jade Robbins is the head of, you know, web design or something. And then you go down the subtree. That's how it kind of works.
Right.
So, and who controls the top level domains is ICANN. If you've ever registered a domain, you probably had to pay the fee for them.
Yeah, the ICANN fee.
ICANN fee, like 18 cents or something. They're the ones that control like what dot things are there are like .net, .com, .us, .me, .whatever. You can have your own if you have your own authoritative domain and all your computers within that intranet are pointed to that DNS. You can say like .dot Robbins, Jade Robbins. Yeah. So there's different DNS records that can be queried from a DNS. So it's not always just address stuff. The first one is the A record, which is address, host name, right?
Right.
The host name to IP.
It's just jaderobbins.com equals XSX, you know, 69.412.
Another common one is MX, which is mail exchanger. It just maps domains to mail transfer agents or MTAs. So like, you know, send mail or,
right,
you know, postfix, any of that stuff.
Because like email is kind of special. It's like its own little thing, right? You know, so oftentimes, you know, for a particular domain, you want the mail server to be specifically something different than your sort of regular server for that address.
Yeah. If you ever set up Google Apps for your domain.
Totally.
You know, you set your MX record to like mail.google.whatever.
Yep.
NS for name server, it delegates DNS zones to use the given authoritative name servers. I think this is for subdomains.
I mean, technically, this is the cool thing about DNS is it is the same for top level domains too. The top level.com domain has an NS record for jaderobbins.com, and that NS record points to ns.dreamhost.com. Mm.
Oh, yeah,
it's
okay.
You know, it's a very distributed system. It's there's really nothing different. I mean, the top level domains are probably using the same software as the lower level ones.
I see. So you could have another DNS server for like another subdomain.
Right, so you it goes to jaderobbins.com, and it says that the name, the authoritative name server for anything .jaderobbins.com is ns.dreamhost.com. It asked ns.dreamhost.com, hey, do you know about jade.awesome.jaderobbins.com? And it says, okay, well, .awesome.jaderobbins.com actually is this other name server, so go ask it. So then it goes to the other one. It's like, oh, yeah, I know jade.awesome.jaderobbins.com.
All right. a host name is a domain with at least one IP address associated. So like example.com, www.example.com, those could have different IP addresses associated to them. As long as they have one, they are host names, whereas like com domain is not. So if you were to just go put com in your URL bar and hit enter, it's not going to go to anything. So you can have a DNS record that doesn't actually go to a host name. Interesting things that I learned about DNS, Unicode characters are actually allowed.
Wow.
So you can actually have support for like foreign language characters and things in the URL, which I haven't seen too many of those, just because I, you know, it kind of you know, if there was, you know, like a special character that you had to type, I don't even know how I would type it to get to
Yeah,
domain.
I think a lot of them are very specialized, like Russian domains might have specific Russian ones, even ones that they really don't want, right. You know, that they don't care if people in the U.S. go to or anywhere else.
Yeah, it's kind of problematic because if they, you know, had a really popular site and we tried to get to it, we, you know, we wouldn't be able to.
Yeah,
unless
dude,
we
no
clicked,
way.
Clicked on a link from Google or something. I personally don't have a special keyboard laying around to do that.
Me either, and I don't know the keys.
I thought it was interesting that they did allow all that, which is cool. A full domain cannot be longer than 253 characters, which I thought was interesting.
Just yeah, wasn't there? Really isn't there some? Domain. There's like some town in Wisconsin or something like that that is like the longest domain in the world because it's the name of the town.
Really?
Yeah, it's some goofy town with like a ridiculous name.
127 levels are allowed in a domain name, so you could have marks.house.in.my.office.marksanborn.net.
Up to 127 levels. Now. Ridiculous.
Yeah. The most widely distributed DNS server is Bind, which is a Unix software.
Yeah, I've actually used Bind. It's very robust. It's been around for a long time, and it's very performant. So that
it was one of the first ones created. It was in the 80s, 84, I think it was when I read
that. Wow.
And then Microsoft ported it to Windows NT in the 90s. So yeah, Bind is the dog.
My first Linux experience actually was when I worked at a company and we started doing hosting for some of our clients, and we ran our own DNS server. I remember the guy, the Linux system administrator, was talking to me. He's like, "Yeah, this is a custom compiled version of Debian that's running Bind." And I was like, "Oh man, that sounds so cool." So that is the lowdown on DNS. Check it out. Check out some of the links and let us know what you think. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys, if you haven't subscribed to the show, to go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can do there. If you want to leave feedback or let us know about something to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback or hit us up on Twitter, twitter.com/faceoffshow. Send us an email, studio@faceoffshow.com. Also, if you go to the feedback, there's all you can leave voicemail, all kinds of web stuff. So let us know, ask us questions, anything you want. We love to hear from you guys. Thank you for listening. We really do appreciate it. And we will see you guys next week.